All right, we're going to ask three people to come up. Can we please have Linus, Tridge, and Bedell please come up? Take a seat. Give him a hand. You do get a chuck chuck as soon as Alan opened it. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, you'll get one. Take a seat. You'll get one after you've worked. Okay, you might have to hold the microphone up. Super Team 3.
What's the softer stuff?
Well, we're ranking you. Have we got any feedback forms? Just to see if this works? No? It'll work. Okay. All right. So, how are we going to run this? Who's got a question? Oh, great start. Fantastic. Harry, you had a question. Please come on down. The price is right. Anyone else over this side want to start coming down? Up the back in the black. Come on down. Hang on. Yes, we have our first question. Do we have our chopper chops open? We do. Thank you. Hang on. What is your question? What's your name?
Daniel.
Daniel, what's your question?
When are we going to stop?
Right about now. Hang on, you're out of order. Harry, you're up.
I'm not answering any of the rest.
Go.
But Dale talked about GNU Radio, which is all about getting out and getting algorithms written early to beat patents. And I just wondered whether there's a need to encourage people to do a lot more of that in software, just hacking things together that are just crazy ideas to try and beat those sorts of issues. Any comments?
I'm not sure that one could really think of the correct algorithm to hack together. That's probably better put to somebody who knows the legal side of things and whether such that would work. I'm not sure it would work with the community either. The thinking of crazy enough ideas. The core problem I see with a lot of patents is more the way the patent office in the US works and the fact that even though things do exist already, they really let it wait for the courts to sort things out and just grant the patent now and assume the courts will sort it out. So I'm not really sure that... I think there is already a lot of prior art out there. I'm not really sure that proactively writing code like that would really work.
So the interesting cases right now are cases where software patents and the Digital Millennium's Copyright Act end up interacting, where there's something that would be easy enough technically to reverse engineer using the techniques that Tridge and others have used so successfully for other protocols and so forth in the past, but where doing so would run afoul of some of the terms of the Digital Millennium's Copyright Act. So I think there's this desire to sort of preemptively have open solutions for things before that particular convergence of laws causes a problem. But I don't know how you do it. I mean, you know, people write code when they're motivated and there's something cool they want to have work that doesn't already work. And, you know, with any luck, it happens in the right time window so that good things happen. But I don't know how you really encourage that other than just writing more good code.
This man, Paul.
I wanted to get this out of the way really early, so when's 2.6 going to be released?
Is it worth one? It's close, go on. When you fix it right?
Any day now. we'll see what happens. Actually, what I'm trying to see happen right now, or the week before I left, was to make sure that we could get a good maintainer for 2.6. And part of that is I have the person picked out already. He's under, as probably most of you already know. And one of the issues with Andrew Martin is that we want the maintenance to be done right, which ends up being an economic issue too. In other words, we want to be able to make sure that Andrew Martin can actually spend his full time on doing maintenance. And that's being worked out actually in Linux World this week. Hopefully some of those issues can be worked out and maybe OSDL can help out and we'll sort that out. And once we have the maintenance issues sorted out, I'll try to dump it over to Andrew as fast as I can, I promise. because it's not much fun waiting for me either. G'day. My question is fairly straightforward. Lots of eyes make all bugs shallow, right?
Perhaps.
This is something which has been, I guess, raised on Slashdot before, and it's something that, yeah, slash what? It's something that I guess continues on in the back of my head, and that is that open source needs people. Obviously, people have a bit of an idea. But is it something that we should be making a little bit of an effort to try and target the adoption and use of Linux and other open source bits and pieces in nations with both a lot of people but would also benefit from it, like India with Bangalore and also parts of Africa, South America's also growing, I guess, but places where potentially there'll be a lot of eyes to look at the code over time, hopefully, and actually assist in the development of bits and pieces. Is it something that we should, throughout the whole open source community, be attempting to look at as an attitude, or is it just a me waffling hot air, looking for a chuppa chup over there?
There it is.
Just putting more people on it doesn't necessarily make bugs shallow. It's important to have people who are motivated in the right way, who want to attack problems, are willing to spend a lot of time building test suites, building... In fact, an example of this is in SAB, we used to take the attitude of pretty much let the users find the bugs. And over the last few years, we've been pushing more towards proactively creating test suites that explore, that automatically test either complete testing of sections of protocol or testing, doing randomized testing, that sort of thing, just because we found that relying on the user community, even with the user community the size we have for Samba, does not find the bugs fast enough. So the sort of the adage of just because you've got a million people using a package, that doesn't mean there isn't an obvious bug there, because it's amazing what people are willing to put up with in terms of both crap code and in terms of, you know, minor irritations or whatever. You need those few people who are willing to put in the extra effort, not just to notice the bugs, willing to report them in a manner that the maintainers can do something about it. And those people are harder. You need a particular culture and a particular attitude among the people who are submitting those bugs. Just injecting huge numbers of people doesn't get you that.
Well, I think that, you know, whether that's really true or not, I think the good news is that, you know, over the last bunch of months as I've been traveling around and talking in various places, all the times I've ended up in what I guess is politically correctly referred to as a developing nation, I've seen great enthusiasm for open source solutions and Linux and so forth. And, you know, I think the closest I've ever come to sort of any, you know, being in the middle of a mob scene at a conference was in a country that is definitely in that state, and they're just wildly enthusiastic to learn about all of this. Philosophically, their heads seem to be in the right place, and they want to try and sort of, you know, make things happen for good reasons, and, you know, those are both economic and technical, and I think there's great promise there. I don't exactly know what we do to foster it other than just, you know, trying to make sure that they have the answers to the questions they have, you know, when they have them, so that they can learn and grow and educate themselves like everyone else.
I just wanted to interject and, like, reinforce Trish's thing. Like, you know, eyeballs are all great, but if you don't report the bugs, it doesn't help.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
You can have another one.
My question is really a kind of meta question, a stand back, and it's not a fully formed question either, but essentially, the world is a very complicated place nowadays in a lot of ways. There's, you know, massive debates about globalism and the negative aspects of globalism. And it strikes me that Linux is an example, a very positive example of globalism. It does strike me that there's been interaction across the whole globe within the mission of Linux that has had a lot of positive human consequences, brings people together, and really leads to philosophically kind of better outcomes for humans in general than big corporations and stuff like that. So I was just wondering, in that mission to kind of move forward, how can we ensure that Linux involves people as much as possible and also engages people in good positive processes? It's just a comment that I think Linux is a positive example of globalism, but how do we ensure that it remains the positive thing, global, experience that it is?
The answer is not to think about it too much.
Yeah. Mark, come on down.
I think that's a good answer in a lot of ways, but it's just that there's yeah. But if it kind of grows inwards, which it could do, I was thinking of schools. And the mini conference on education is really, really important. But anyway, just a comment. Thanks.
Individual groups do their own thing, and that's encouraged within the Linux culture. But I think if we too much introspection on that culture, it would in fact be detrimental to the culture.
Yeah.
Not thinking about it too much. I was not just tongue in cheek there. It has worked really well. The culture is built up through people just doing it for their own reasons, people enjoying the work or whatever, enjoying what their hobby. And so unless we see a downturn or something, it's starting to fail, then we don't really need to spend a lot of our time wondering, it might happen. Some people might suddenly find that, I don't know, Linus turns into a bastard or something, or it turns into a lifestyle at work.
But the other thing I think is good in terms of survival is diversity, and Linux obviously is a very diverse. There's a lot of diversity in
Yeah.
Thank you,
Mark.
So since Rusty was talking about 2.6, I was wondering if you thought you would have enough time to rewrite all of firewalling and filtering with brand new user tools.
There's probably three more revisions in there.
If I may respond to that.
He just wants another pop, right?
bring those over here. Okay, the classic joke was at Sydney 2001 when somebody stood up and asked the question, is there going to be a new rewrite of firewalling in 2.5? And I said, no. And the next question was, so what are you going to call it? And Chris Stavoni yelled out, Rusty Chains. But the answer's still no.
I don't have a deep philosophical or political question.
Okay! Hey, you just take one.
given that there's obviously, I think, it's certainly been a perception that 2.5 has had some IDE instability and so on and so forth. Would you say it's ready now for non-kernel hackers like myself to start mucking around with, given that we can't afford to destroy hardware?
Well, if
oh, a load of hell.
If you can't afford to lose your disk contents,
yeah.
You should always be a bit nervous. I mean, you should be nervous even if you're using 2.4. backups are a good thing. So with that out of the way, it does depend a lot on your hardware. I use 2.5 on everything, always, right? And so far, I haven't lost a single piece of data due to any of the 2.5 issues. I've lost data due to stupidity, but that's not a kernel's problem. It depends partly on your hardware. Right now, we seem to be at the stage where mostly if it boots for you and if it compiles for you, most of it seems to work, right?
Okay.
But
thank you.
If you have problems, just report them.
Your mileage may vary. This side. You? What's your name? Jeff. Hello, Jeff. Welcome today. Take a chat.
So users can be a blessing and a serious pain in the ass. How do you guys handle the pressure of user demand and user requirements and those sorts of things?
Because what pressure?
Well, the GNOME project gets kind of, maybe it's different doing a desktop project. I don't think it would be something.
No, this is another one of those. I wasn't really being facetious. You have to decide whether you feel pressured by these things or not. I mean, every once in a while, there's this huge convergence of people asking things like, when is GZIP going to be rsyncable? And but in general, I think you just have to decide what attitude you're going to take. And, you know, requests are one thing, but pressure? It's supposed to be fun, right?
I have to agree on that. I mean, I love you all, but when you send me email, I will just regard them as just another email. I get too many of those. I very seldom try to feel pressurized into doing anything. I sometimes get irritated, and that when I get really irritated, I actually have to stand back and not sit at the computer for a day, because when I get irritated, I get irritated at everybody who starts sending me email. I don't care that much about my users. That's what distribution houses are there for, right? I mean, they actually get money for doing it, and they try to sell stuff to users, and that's how they stay alive. And I care about the technology, and there's no pressure on that front.
Well, see, I beg to differ. Like, I actually care about my users, both of them. No, I mean, it's difficult because you're supposed to be responsive to, you know, somebody sends you an email, they're not doing it to, you know, to give you shit. They're actually trying to contribute. So, well, yeah, you are. So usually, you know, you try to wade through and you try to get some use out of what they've sent you, right? But
please welcome Rusty Rucker to the stage. I'm tired of him standing there.
I think it is still,
keep going.
It is still mostly.
Yeah, share that one. What,
it is still mostly an attitude thing, right?
God, like a performing
field.
The
problem is when it crosses a line, you just get really frustrated. You know, they've spent 8 hours trying to get something to work. It turns out that it was some minor documentation bug or something that completely sent them to the wrong track, and you get this flame. It's really hard because your natural reaction is just to bin it or flame it back, but you really do have to pay some attention to that. Because if enough users are hitting the same problem, it's probably your fault, not their fault.
But if you get enough of these over time, you eventually learn how to read the bug report without reading the flame. And the only time it gets really frustrating is when you have, like, you know, 20 or 30 flames in a row, and then, you know, you sometimes do want to get up and, you know, go play with your kids for a while instead. But you know, in general, I mean, you know, people don't generally take the time to send you a request or bug report or whatever unless there's something that's on their mind, something that they really think you could do differently or better. And I choose to treat all of those as useful inputs, not as, you know, pressure points.
So the ones that are like, your car's a bomb, it's the wrong color, all the seats are uncomfortable, by the way, can I drive it down to the shops? That gets grating after a while. There's no magic way of getting over it.
Well, I found that the last few years I've been working in jobs where Sam was sort of part of my job in a way, and so I always like having other projects where there's no pressure. And so that's one of the things, for instance, I did, like, Nightcap, a chess program. You know, nobody's company depends on this chess program working. So I always seem to have one or two projects that are zero pressure, that you just do it purely for the enjoyment, and you know that no one's going to be, you know, really depending on this being exactly right the first time or whatever.
Once you've been through a couple of amateur satellite launch campaigns when they're going to light the fuse on such and such a date, and if it doesn't work by then, it doesn't go then, maybe not ever, there's very little about the open source community.
Cool. Thanks, Jeff.
Cheers, Jenna.
Of the four x86 vendors, three have announced hardware in the pipeline that will have a feature, in inverted commas, that only runs signed trusted code. Now, this has gotten a lot of press about how bad this is for reverse engineering, da-da-da-da-da. Do you see it as an enabling feature in that, okay, I can set up my box so that I trust Bedale and I trust stuff that I can file and nothing else runs on the box?
That's how my box is working at the moment.
You trust my code?
I can't talk for one of the vendors you're talking about, but I can relate to a conversation with another of the vendors you're talking with, where their engineers asked me whether I could see any actual use for the feature they're putting in, and I hewed and hummed for a while and then said no. And they said, yeah, that's what we thought too. And the fact is there's probably going to come, a few good things will come out of it. One is, I know Transmeta does hardware acceleration of encryption, which is good in itself, right? Just ignore the DRM stuff. Yeah. I don't think anybody wants it. I don't think it's, right now it's a marketing thing and some companies are pushing for it. And if people don't buy into it, it won't sell. And right now, from what I can tell, none of these situations are, we will not run unsigned code. Sure. It's more, if the code isn't signed, you don't get access to this one mode, which is the mode that the Sonys and companies will want to use. But we can just ignore that mode for now.
I've
asked this of a couple of people, but who said that if you want your hardware supported, that you should ask the developers, what do you use? So on your desktops or whatever.
Well, I've got, you know, Debian Linux running on a ThinkPad, but I also have a collection of odds and sods boxes. Various vendors have sent me boxes, sort of, I don't know, Sun and MIPS and others that I've got stuck up in my roof. And so I tend to test on a bunch of different boxes. And then we have a build farm type thing where we test on others. But I think a lot of the larger projects have access to that type of thing. But there was always the thing of sort of which, you know, using, having the right Ethernet card, the same one that Linus had, was always a good idea.
Because, yeah, PC-MA10, it's like there, right? So when I'm sitting in the laptop, he's sitting there, so I just throw things in that direction. That helps. Try to do that.
Okay.
I have this strange situation that I have two kinds of machines that I use. One is the machine I take on trips, which is usually the smallest, lightest one I can find, which happens to be a Sony laptop. The machine I do all my work on is the most beefy machine I can find that doesn't sound like a jet engine. And right now that's a dual Xeon 2.4 gigahertz HT-enabled thing. But I actually switch machines every 6 months because I get them for free. So one of them. So it's hard to track me. I mean, or let's put it this way: it's really expensive.
As a sub question to that, can I have your old machine?
Get me another box.
Yeah, take another one. Someone on this side? Yep.
Rusty's up now, so I'm not going to ask the question about documentation using the example I was going to use, so I'll have to switch to the philosophical kind of one now instead. Sorry. Okay, in the last couple of months, people, and there's a lot of governments have been, sorry, in Slashdot, so it must be true. A lot of governments are actually seriously finally considering Linux, you know, for TCO issues and whatever, but why does everyone think it's finally, like, reached critical mass, you know? Actually being looked into for proper adoption instead of just being tossed around like it's been for years.
They're just slow.
Okay. Right.
The change to the Microsoft licensing has had a significant impact as to why it might be happening now rather than earlier. I think that's definitely a significant factor. They're going to the new licensing schemes that are less convenient for many companies and becoming very expensive.
Well, also in all fairness, look at where the desktop is today and where it was just a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
I mean, OpenOffice made a huge deal. Mozilla finally being useful, even if it's slow and bloated and big, made a big deal, right? So a year and a half ago, you couldn't reasonably have put a Linux desktop in front of most people. These days, you actually can. I mean, some of them will be unhappy, but you can put Linux on the desktop in an office environment, and they won't think it's that different anymore. And that's new.
That was one of the things that Radda was talking about in 2001 at LTA.
Well, and there's going to be all sorts of noise in New York in the next couple of days at the Linux World conference about, there's all sorts of announcements and counter-announcements about, you know, desktop Linux consortia and so forth. It's a very hot topic right now. And, you know, after all of this time where people have been saying, well, gee, Linux is really great on servers and, you know, network edge appliances and just isn't quite there for the desktop, or, you know, something else still owns the desktop or whatever. I think the time has come where people are starting to go, it's just not true anymore. And right. And I think, you know, so you could ask why, you know, I said earlier, because they're slow. I mean, you can ask why is it taking so long to realize this. There's just inertia all over the place, and particularly in government organizations, which is where the original question came from. There's just process inertia all over the place.
Then, to be cynical for a while, apparently if you say you're considering switching to Linux, you get a better deal from Microsoft.
The corollary of what Biel was saying is that...
Pick it up.
Sorry. The corollary of what Biel was saying is that I actually don't think we've hit critical mass yet. I think in 3 years' time we'll look back and we'll say, no, we hit critical mass in like 04 or something, right? We hit critical mass when we hit 50% of the desktop market.
Ooh, great word.
If you look back at the history of Linux so far, and all the time we thought, wow, this is, you know, this is the next big thing. Every time we made some incremental jump, we thought, wow, we turned the corner. And then we look back on that 2 years later, and we can hardly remember it because it was just, you know, it was way down the curve.
As long as the trend line stays in the right direction, I don't really care where the inflection points are.
Yeah. Next up.
Every year, or every 2 years for the last 20 years, I've been to a conference of one kind or another where we've talked about innovation, we're talking about Linux taking over the desktop, we're talking about new stuff happening. 20 years ago on my desktop, I had a PC with a word processor and a spreadsheet where I could print letters to my mum. Today, I've got a PC on my desktop with a word processor and a spreadsheet where I can print letters to my mum and do something. What's changed? What fundamentally...
It's much slower now.
I'll take my hat.
And you have 7,000 DB cables on the hard drive that you never use.
In the possibly lesser informed media, I've been getting, it's been a little bit longer, I've talked about it, there's a general opinion that 2.4 isn't as stable as the good old 2.2 was. I'm not sure whether that's actually true. I was wondering, with the 2.6, do you have any predictions on whether everyone's suddenly going to say, wow, this is more stable than ever before, or will it all just move along and everyone say, wow, 2.6 isn't as stable as the good old 2.4 was?
Well, Microsoft... I think it's kind of true that 2.2 was more stable than 2.4, but it's true for the wrong reasons. Or the main issue really is a lot more people are using 2.4 in a lot more diverse environments than people tended to use 2.2 historically. And I think that's actually a bigger issue, that if you look at how Linux usage has been historically, it's been fairly technical desktop kind of usage or server usage, which are simpler. I think we're seeing a lot more varied hardware. We're seeing a lot more interesting usage patterns. Somebody using GIMP or something like that will stress the machine a hell of a lot more than than somebody who just compiles all the time. So I think that's part of it. I'll obviously claim that 2.6 will be entirely stable. People won't even discuss it because it will be so self-funded.
If I could stick an oar in as the 2.2 maintainer. Well, the little thing you have to remember about all of these things, early versions of 2.2 sucked. Early versions of 2.0 sucked. People are always comparing 2.2 or whatever, 18 months, 2 years on, against 2.4, where you're still finding more bugs. The 2.2 kernel of about the same time as the 2.4 kernel now probably wasn't that much more stable. What's happened is that 2.2 has settled down to the point where we're changing 40 or 60k worth of patch changes or release. Nothing much changes. All of the bugs people hit have been found. And if you wanted to compare fairly, you have to ask things like, was 2.4.9 any better than 2.2.9? And I think the answer probably was 2.4.9 probably was better than 2.2.9. So be careful how you compare them.
We'll keep on this. We've got 10 minutes left.
How many free software packages have you personally founded?
Huh? You've done one? What?
I've done a bunch, but a lot of them are very, very small. I don't know, when I join a company, I've got to list them for, you know, copyright reasons. It's like 20 or 25 or something, but a lot of them are really small. One I'm proudest of is, I think, the smallest Debian package. It's 5 lines of C. Packaged by Rusty. So a lot of them are very, very small.
There are no outstanding critical bugs either.
I don't know, like, if a dozen or two, but unless you're a ham radio operator, you probably don't know about most of them. So.
Okay.
I was just curious, if you think of your average workday, how much of it's spent reading email, on phone, looking at code, talking to lawyers? What do you guys do in your average workday?
Yeah.
Silver. Well, on the phone, CRO, talking to lawyers, CRO, reading email, 10 hours a day.
Stan has got worse recently.
I was going to say, I have to admit that for many years I've been sort of conscious of the fact that my job basically is to answer my email, but that's because almost everything else that I'm involved in is being worked on with people in other places, and we're discussing things via email and so forth. So, you know, reading my email isn't just sort of like reading messages and sending replies. It's read the message, go, go over and look at a hunk of code, or go chase down some packaging issue, or go look at that particular piece of the website and yell at somebody and then come back and send a reply. So I spend way too many hours a day with an IRC client open so I can poke other people in the Debian project. I spend, I think, the unsorted non-mailing list emails down to only about 300 items a day. But there are, I don't know, several thousand others on mailing list that I sort of try to keep up with.
Well, for me, it varies a lot between, you know, I tend to go 2 or 3 months of, you know, really intense coding, and then I might have, you know, a couple of months where I'm really slack and I'm looking at stuff, and so it tends to very much vary. I don't know whether it's the season or the phase of the moon or whatever, but it tends to go up and down a lot as to exactly what I'm working on. Yeah, that's
true. For someone who wants to become involved in one of the larger projects, Samba, the kernel, any of these, would you say that the barriers to entry, I perceive the barriers to entry as rising continually. What would your comments be on that? That other than the technical issues, there's also the political issues of, yeah.
It's clearly true that the barriers to entry are going up. That doesn't mean that it's impossible. I mean, there are several developers that, at least in the kernel, who came to Linux kernel. It didn't take them that long to convince everybody that they knew what they were talking about, right? Mm-hmm. It happens, but it's harder to get into it than it certainly was 10 years ago.
You talked about this in this talk.
But that's okay, because I think actually a lot of the more interesting work tends to be done in new projects. You don't have to stay with the same old projects. We're doing okay in the kernel. Bet Samba is doing fine, as is, and a lot of the open source excitement should be about new projects and doing things, new things where entry is easier. And the fact that it's slightly harder to enter the kernel means that it's just the natural result of the fact that there's 12 years of work in that piece of code, and you kind of need to get up to speed on it. You can start with simple, small changes. I mean, some people start by just searching for typos, and there's more of them than want to have, but that's one way of getting at it. But I really think that the real answer is that if you're finding some project too hard to get into, there are other projects.
Also, please remember that the kernel, and I assume the same is true for Samba, Apache, or any of the other large projects, they aren't really one project. You know? The kernel is so full of miscellaneous little projects, some of which are, you know, very well maintained, and the barriers of entry to get into the core kernel code, yeah, they're astronomically high. That's partly because there's some very good people working in that area, and they're being actively maintained. There are other parts of the kernel that are kind of got left behind, or you know, really needs to be dealt with, and are a lot further out in the periphery. Same thing with Apache. If you go to the Apache team and want to hack on the core Apache code, they'll probably kind of look at you funny. But if you say, well, I'm going to write a module to do this, that, or the other thing, they're like, oh, please, you know, thank you.
I think also the barrier to entry has been rising even for new projects. And the expectations that the community has on a new project is considerably higher now than it was previously, in that I think
your first release has to work, and work really
that's
well.
That's right. People actually expect it to compile these days. It really was quite different 10 years ago. People put out a project and, you know, it was not unexpected on a mailing list or something that it doesn't compile for me, or, you know, try this or whatever. That is a bit of a problem, but to counterbalance that, there's more good examples of code out there that you can learn from. So there's more resources available to help you. But I think the barrier to entry has risen even for new projects considerably.
Before we go on, we've probably got enough people sitting down, because we've only got about a few minutes, but if we chat to people who are still sitting, Leon?
Yeah. I like what you said about just ignoring people, Linus, because I think if there's enough Linux around and it doesn't work with Linux, it won't sell. And even if people do try to sell it, they can find someone like Spice, who's really good at blowing people up and send them to the office. But the question I wanted to ask was a meta question. It's almost on behalf of the Canberra and Adelaide people. And I've been sitting here watching James running around like a triple head, and all the people in the committee getting things together. And you, Linus in particular, has come across and done things like hop into my wife's penguin suit that he's never done before.
Yeah, that just takes on anyway. That was great.
Obviously, we've done something right, but it may not be clear to people what that is. Now, I've seen you do photo shoots. I've seen you spend less time with your wife and kids than I do, which is, you know, bad enough. And I was just wondering what someone who is planning a conference or something like that should do to make life easier for you. Now, Linus is really the expert, because he's the one who suffers most from attending conferences, but all of you must have a perspective. We've got feedback forms on the speakers and everything like that, but we've got no feedback forms for us, you know? What do we do right to make the conference better for you?
More chuppy chups?
I like the one where everyone chanted my name every time I walked in the room. That was good. That was good.
Take another one.
You did fine. I mean, I'm not actually going to conferences much anymore. The biggest issues I tend to have is just logistics, and as long as everything's taken care of, going to a conference is actually vacation for me. That's literally how I see it, because it's not work. My real work is doing coding, and I don't go to a conference unless it's vacation. It's don't
worry about it. Trust me.
Okay.
Any comments, Rich?
Maybe that applies, you know, like the comment earlier about not thinking about it too much, being a bit relaxed about it. That's the really nice thing about this, and the really technical conference here, which is a good example, is that it's a very relaxed atmosphere. There isn't really, really high expectations, but it's a really good result anyway, through a relaxed attitude.
It's got the same ad hoc effect as the coding itself, you reckon?
Yeah.
Like, I see people in the audience with their laptops with shells up coding Perl and stuff like that. You wouldn't see that at a Microsoft conference.
I've done what for me seems like a really insane amount of traveling in the last year. I've spoken on, I guess, every... I've been to a lot of places and talked at a lot of conferences in the last year. And I don't know that I have any really sort of wonderful pearls to throw out about this. It's nice to feel welcome. It's nice to have, as Linda suggested, it's nice to have the sort of the logistical arrangements just sort of work well. I'm sort of a special case in that regard because my employer wants to cover my travel expenses and be involved in the arrangements everywhere I go. That's HP, by the way. And
where we sign up?
They picked up the freight for me to be here and helped with my wife, too. So, you know, give them a little credit where credit's due. So that imposes an extra little hitch once in a while for, you know, for me to make arrangements for things, but I can't really think of anything. I just, you know, you guys are a fun bunch of folks to hang out with, and I enjoy the conversation, and frankly, unlike some of the places I've been in the last year, I think the conference in Brisbane last year and the one this year are both things I'm going to go away feeling sort of energized and excited from. Some of them are just sort of a drag. I don't really know what the difference is.
I'd like to point out that the penguin suit, even though people thought I was crazy for getting into that hot thing, it's doing something fun. I mean, the worst thing about conferences is giving the standard canned talks, which aren't much fun for the audience or for the person who gives them. Everybody hates giving talks. Almost everybody hates giving talks.
Nothing great.
And I mean, I've tried for Linux World, I tried for 2 years to get them to have a dunk tank for me, literally. You know, one of those places where you throw balls to get me to fall in the water? And that was just for fun, having something like interesting to do. And they wouldn't do it because they're not that kind of conference.
But Cameron, Adelaide, honestly.
Thank you very much.
But we talked about travel, you said about HP picking up, and I don't think I should bring it up at this stage. We need to really thank IBM, because IBM helped us bring Linux in here. So a big thanks to IBM. Next question, let's get going. We're going to have to take probably, what, two more, three more? We can get going? 2 minutes each, so.
Apart from me not being very buff, why aren't all the women here?
Who has that mailing list?
I brought my wife. I mean,
yeah. He brought three.
I brought four women.
My daughter really wanted to come, but it's, you know, she's in school in the Northern Hemisphere right now, so.
I'd like to see a few more, for obvious reasons, but apart from those.
Hang on.
You can't have mine.
On the women issue, I know we've got a few groups of Linux-interested women who've kind of talked about this issue, and one of the problems is that every conference we come to, the women sitting in the audience get to hear, so why aren't there more women here? And frankly, that makes the women sitting here, some of us who are a little bit less self-confident, because women are trained to be less self-confident, it makes us think that we don't count. That the ones sitting here aren't enough, and so kind of think about what you said. Seriously, if you want more women here, don't pick up on any of us, unless you're...
unless you're buffed.
Or rusty.
We're here as professionals, we're here as thinkers, we're here as creators, we're not here as potential dates and sets of boots. I'm sorry, and you're not here as muscles, and you're not here as pretty face, you're here as thinkers. We're here as fellow professionals. So respect us on the level of equals, think with us, talk with us, share ideas with us, and treat us like human beings.
Which side are we up to? That's Dex, yep, just come down.
Okay, so 12 years ago, there was this random uni student who started writing a operating system kernel, and now it's become something very big, and people are doing conferences, and it's sort of cascaded into something huge. Now, if someone was starting an open source project now, do you think there's any kind of opportunity for them to have, you know, for the project to grow to the same extent that Linux did?
No.
There's only one. There can be only one. I don't know. I think you have to have a, you have to have a vacuum. You really have to have something where nobody else is doing that. And it is harder to find. I think it's the same issue as the entry into the project getting slightly higher. It's harder to find a vacuum for open source because there's a lot more diverse open source than there was 12 years ago. 12 years ago there were a lot of open source, but they were tended to be very specific in certain areas. And you just need to find something new. And it's always hard to find something new, and you don't know beforehand whether you found it. You'll know 12 years afterwards.
I think I can safely say that writing an operating system is not the thing to do today. On the x86 assembly news group, which I frequent, we get this question at least once a week. Hi, I'm trying to write an operating system. How does the boot sector work?
We're going to have to move really quickly because we have gone past the time. So
I think on the sort of running operating system thing, I was quite impressed when I got VGA characters printed on the screen. So, you know, if you can get that far, at least it's, you know, something. just a question, you can probably guess what I'm going to ask. No, okay, what do you guys think of IPv6? Do you think it's going anywhere, in your opinion? Have you tried it? I don't know.
I'm the wrong person to ask about IPv6 because I don't know enough. I can tell by the kinds of things I see. IPv4 is good enough for 99% of all people, which makes it really hard to enter with IPv6. All the infrastructure is there for IPv4 to get IPv6 to the point where people would actually want to switch, other than people who have some innate reason to switch to IPv6, and there aren't that many of them. I see that as a decade away. The reason that to make IPv6 work may be the mobile phone people are really pushing IPv6. The address space thing has never been true. That's why we have anonymous subnets, and you don't want to give your shoe its own IP address. Maybe you want to give your shoe its own IP address some way, but you don't want the outside world to know that shoe's IP
just
address.
Right?
So IPv4 has plenty of IP addresses. They're not just public, right? So I'm saying, yeah, IPv6, to me, it looks like it's just fighting against the momentum of IPv4, and that will mean it's a decade away.
I think we'll have to drag you in an issue.
But I may be wrong. I've been wrong before.
Yeah,
not
okay.
All.
I know, look, Trish.
The problem
with
IT,
we fix
it up, Dean, is that the benefit is relatively small, so the barrier to entry has got to be equally small. And so if it was just a matter of when you compile something, have, you know, minus D IPv6 equals 1, and then your application suddenly compiles IPv6, all the applications would have it. But it is still a relatively difficult task to write portable IPv6 code that runs on, other than Linux, it runs on a bunch of OSs. And that barrier is sufficiently high relative to the gain that you get from it that it means that a lot of apps don't do it. So I suppose that those IPv6 enthusiasts need to have to take that into account to have make it a little bit easier. But it has, unfortunately, you're fighting a difficult game because the gain is so small. It has to be incredibly easy, almost to the point of like Soxify type stuff, where you can just Soxify this and oh, it suddenly works. Without that, it's unless you made it that easy, then you'll see a lot of applications not bothering.
I don't know what you're
asking. Okay. No, unfortunately, I think I'm being told we can have one more question. One more question, sorry.
As an IT professional, I find like I'm always feeling behind the eight ball, like I never know enough. It doesn't matter how much I learn, it just continuously grows the amount of knowledge out there and I can't keep up. Do you guys ever feel the same sort of thing? And what do you guys and what do you guys do for your own professional development? Do you have, sort of think that you guys really to try and develop your own skills?
So my secret is taking credit for other people's work.
All right, unfortunately we are out of time. We have gone 10 minutes over. Has this been worthwhile?
Yeah?
All right. So, okay. But you do have plenty of time to come and talk to this, haven't you, Mark? Oh, just as an interest, who's going to the Linux Australia AGM? Can I have a show of hands? About half? Okay. That's fine. It's in the same venue. We do have to thank our four people who have come up here. Please put your hands together for B-Dow, Fred, Linus and Rusty. I have far too many Chupa Chups left. Yeah, well, they're going off. If you'd like one, come down and see me. Thank you.